We've done the introduction to Hebrews. We've completed chapter 1, and so now we're on to chapter 2. And in Hebrews chapter 2, the author continues his theme that Jesus is superior to the angels. And verses 1 to 4 are the first of five warnings in the book. And this first warning is on the danger of neglecting what we've heard. So I'll read verses 1, 2, and 3. For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we've heard so that we do not drift away from it. For since the message spoken through angels was binding, and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment, how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, after it was at the first spoken through the Lord? It was then confirmed to us by those who heard him. And in verse 2, he spoke about the word spoken through angels, referring to the giving of the Mosaic law on Mount Sinai. And while we don't discover that the law was mediated by angels in Exodus, we do read in Galatians, that's Galatians 3:19, and also in Acts 7, verse 53, that the law was mediated to Moses through angels. And this actually was part of a long Jewish tradition and makes sense, as Moses, you'll remember, was only allowed to see the afterglow of the Lord when he was hidden in the cleft of the rock on the mountain. So using angels as mediators seems to have been what took place in the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. However, whatever happened on the mountain, the author's argument is that now the gospel has been spoken directly through the Son of God, the incarnate God-man, without any mediation. And if in the Old Testament they didn't escape punishment for neglecting the word mediated through angels, and remember that 3,000 died in the incident of the golden calf, how shall we now avoid punishment if we neglect the words spoken directly by the Son of God himself? Then in verses 6 to 9, he gives the first of seven expositions of a specific Old Testament passage. Okay, as I said, he refers to dozens of Old Testament passages, but also gives an in-depth commentary and application of seven detailed passages in various chapters of the book of Hebrews. And all these are of crucial importance to his overall arguments. And the first is an exposition of Psalm 8, verses 4 through 6. And he introduces the quote by saying in verse 5, "For he did not subject to angels the world to come, concerning which we are now speaking." And what he's saying here is that God entrusted to the angels the administration of the present world, but he will not entrust the administration of the world to come to angels. And just as an aside, the biblical evidence for the angelic government of the world, the kind of angelic superintending of the world, goes back to Deuteronomy 32, verse 8. And there in the Greek translation we read, "When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the children of men, he set the bounds of the peoples according to the number of the angels of God." And this seems to imply that the administration of the various nations was parceled out among a corresponding number of angelic powers. And it's interesting that this is also confirmed by the rabbinic interpretation of Deuteronomy 32. So it's not a kind of Protestant novelty. It has a very ancient tradition in Jewish exegesis. But tragically, as we know, a percentage of the angels rebelled against the Lord, which is why we now wrestle with fallen angels that Paul describes as principalities and powers. And as you know, and as you'll remember, we find a reference to this in Daniel 10, when Daniel speaks about a powerful fallen angel called the Prince of Persia. Daniel was praying, and the angel Gabriel comes and tells him that on the first day that he started to pray, his prayer was heard, but the answer was contested by an angelic power called the Prince of Persia. Then, of course, the world to come that is just spoken of in verse 5 is speaking of the new creation that's been inaugurated by the enthronement of Jesus at the right hand of God and will be consummated at the end of the age. So the writer wants to continue to stress that Christ is superior to all and every angelic being. And while the old order was administrated by angelic beings, the new creation is administered by Christ alone and has already been launched by his death and by his resurrection. Then he continues in verses 6 to 8 and says, "But one has testified somewhere saying," and now comes a quote from Psalm 8, "What is man that you remember him, or the son of man that you're concerned about him?" And the phrase "son of man" here is simply a way of speaking of humankind, as it often is in the Old Testament. It's not speaking of Christ at this point. And then he continues with the quotation, "You have made him for a little while lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor, and have appointed him over the works of your hands. You have put all things in subjection under his feet." And Psalm 8, as you probably know, was originally speaking of man's dignity and his authority over the creation, even though we know that because of the tragedy of the fall, this dominion is now very much reduced. However, and this is his big move, now the psalm is applied by the author of Hebrews to the second Adam, to Christ, who by his incarnation has become the head of a new race, a new humanity. And the bombshell that the author now explodes on his readers is that the original creation mandate given to Adam has now been renewed in Christ. And the good news is that God will not give up on his creation, and that in Jesus he has decisively proclaimed a resounding no to our rebellion that would have led to the disintegration of the cosmos and turned everything on its head in the person of Jesus. And these are truly amazing words. And while they might be familiar to us, they would have been dynamite to the discouraged Jewish believers who first read them. And we should also note that in verse 7, where he says, "You have made him for a little while lower than the angels," he's speaking of the temporary humiliation that Jesus embraced in the incarnation. But now we read that he has crowned him with glory and honor and appointed him as the last Adam over all the works, over all the works of God's hands. And then in Hebrews 2:8 he continues, "For in subjecting all things to him," That is the person of Christ. He left nothing that is not subject to him, that is to Christ. However, we do not yet see, all things subjected to him. In other words, Jesus has been enthroned at the right hand of God. He's been given all authority, but his reign on the earth is still resisted. And so we don't yet see all things subjected to him, which of course is obvious when we pick up a newspaper and read of the chaos in the world everywhere we look. But then he goes on to say that it's what we do see, but not with the physical eye, that we need to focus on if we're to see things from God's perspective. So in verse 9 we read, "But we do see him who was made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, so that by the grace of God," which is actually better translated, "so that apart from the grace of God," referring to the cross, where he was separated from his Father by the sin of the world. So I'll just back up. But we do see Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, so that apart from God, he might taste death for everyone. And as I said, it's obvious that we don't yet see everything subject to Christ, which was a problem for the Jewish believers, as they expected that when the Messiah came, everything would be immediately subjected to him. So what he emphasizes is that while we don't yet see it, we do know by faith that because of his death and resurrection, Jesus has been crowned with glory, that he has tasted death for everyone. And therefore, the reign of sin and death has been decisively terminated, and that this will be seen by all men at the end of the age when he returns. And again, while these truths are familiar to us, these Old Testament messianic prophecies now required a reappraisal and a reevaluation in the light of Christ by the believing Jews who first read the book of Hebrews. Then, moving on, in verse 10, we get the first of three passages in the book speaking of how Jesus became a perfect high priest. Although, as we'll see, the author has not yet finished demonstrating that Jesus is superior to the angels. And he'll return to this theme actually in verse 11. But first in verse 10, he begins to show how Jesus became a perfect high priest. So I'll read it. "For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and through whom are all things." And again, these are astonishing things to say of a carpenter from Nazareth. "For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author," or we could translate it, "the pioneer or pathfinder of their salvation through sufferings." And where he's going here is an argument that he'll develop later in some depth. But as I've already said, simply becoming incarnate did not qualify Jesus to be our high priest. I should perhaps say did not immediately qualify Jesus to be our high priest. Prior to the incarnation, Jesus had perfect knowledge of human life, but he had no personal experience of human life. And again, as I've said before, to know all about cancer is not the same as having experienced it. And the only way the Son of God could have a personal experience of human life was, of course, by becoming one of us, by becoming the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, a passage, of course, we all know well. And Hebrews will go on to tell us that his struggle against sin, his battle against Satan, his interaction with our diseases and heartaches all formed him into one who could compassionately represent us before the throne of God. And so now, rather than condemning us for our human frailties and weaknesses, Hebrews says that he now identifies with us in them. He can truly represent us before the Father because he knows by personal experience that planet Earth is a hard neighborhood to live in. However, this does not, of course, excuse our guilt, but it does mean that Jesus can truly have compassion on us in his high priestly ministry because he has walked where we walked. He experienced what we experienced. Our heartaches, our sufferings are not foreign to Jesus because of his incarnation. And before moving on, we should note that when it says in verse 10 that, quote, the author of our salvation was perfected through suffering, it's not saying that Jesus was ever imperfect, but rather that through his sufferings, he was perfectly formed into one who could be our high priest and representative as a man before God. The perfecting was not of his person, but rather that through his suffering, not only on the cross, but also in his ministry, he was molded into one who could understand our sufferings and so compassionately represent us before God. It's amazing. It's a miracle. The great love and loving kindness of our God and Savior. Then verses 11, 12, and 13, the author swings back to his theme that Jesus is superior to the angels. And this time, he'll argue that in becoming a man, he can identify with us as no angel ever could. Verse 11. For both he who sanctifies, in the sense of cleansing, and those who are sanctified are all from one Father. Actually, Father is not in the Greek here. A better reading of the verse would go something like this. For both he who sanctifies or cleanses and those who are sanctified or cleansed are all from one stock, from one common humanity, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren.